And now, here's the right way to do a seamless transition.
Braun Strowman's on the loose right now. Someone needs to do something about
this. Somebody needs to call the police. That's what they need to do. They need to call the police right now.
And here's the wrong way to do a seamless transition.
The Royal Rumble event is surely going to be historic, but gentlemen, SmackDown Live just got glorious. No, Byron.
Sorry.
The music says it.
I jumped the gun. I'm sorry. I got excited.
Unbelievable, Byron. Unbelievable.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Fat delete.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 531 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, January 21st. 2018, I am the Solid Monster. Damn it, Byron. I feel Tom Phillips' pain when I hear things like that. Now, imagine having to work with him every week. Now, I kid, Byron, but we have news this week. We have a lot of news this week on Roman Reigns. We have news on Raw 25, which is finally upon us tomorrow night. Very excited. The possible location for WrestleMania 35... the state of Alberto El Patron, who is angling for one last run with WWE. Try not to laugh. Plus my NXT TakeOver predictions and thoughts on episode 1 of the Mixed Match Challenge. So it's a lot of ground to cover. But first, I want to thank all of you for making the Sound Off the number one ranked sports and recreation podcast on all of Podbean for 2017. That's 3 years in a row now. Pretty cool stuff. If you want to keep the momentum going, you could head on over to WrestlingRadioAwards.com. You could vote for the Sound Off for Show of the Year from the little drop-down menu, or you can vote for either of the interviews, if not both of the interviews I did with Brandi Rhodes and Justin Roberts for Female and Media Interview of the Year, respectively. You can also vote for Wrestler of the Year and a bunch of other categories as well, not just podcast stuff. So you have until January 28th, so 2 weeks. Actually, what am I talking about? 1 week. You got 1 week left, so head on over to WrestlingRadioAwards.com for that. The Royal Rumble Pool. The Royal Rumble Pool in the Facebook group. We now have well over 1,800, soon to be 1,900 entrants and counting. 63 total pools last I checked a few minutes ago. I think we had 73 last year, so we're not too far off. Zach Hulker, and again, big shout out to Zach for putting all this together every year now. This is the fifth year in a row he puts his heart and soul into this thing, so I want to thank him publicly for that. He has posted everybody's numbers. As of last night, the numbers are out. If you have not gotten your number, and it is possible there are a few people who didn't see their name in the group. By the way, everybody is asking, hey, what's my number, what's my number? And other people have to go fishing for it. There's a little function on your keyboard called Control F, okay? Use the search function, for God's sakes. Type your name in, and if it's on the list, it'll come up. You don't have to ask other people to find your name for you. But there are a few people whose names were left off. If that's the case, just put a comment in the post addressed to Zach, and I'm sure he'll take care of you. But check the group if you don't know your number yet. I see that I drew number 7 this year. Lucky 7. I think I drew 23 last year, which was Randy Orton, which was spot on. I am a little less confident about number 7. I'm not sure anybody has ever won the Royal Rumble before from the number 7 spot. Perhaps somebody can check that out and let me know if I'm wrong. But you can still like the original post and join the pool. It is not too late. The pool is going to be open up until a few hours before the pay-per-view next Sunday when lifeguard Zach ends his shift. So the pool is open until then. It's not too late. The way it works is that if the person who wins the men's, and we're only talking about the men's rumble, this does not apply to the women's rumble, sorry ladies, but if the person who wins the men's Royal Rumble match enters at the number that you have been assigned, you win your pool. You then advance to the final ultimate rumble pool, where I will be choosing the first, second, and third place winners at random. It is totally random stuff. I'll pick a third place winner. They'll get a prize. Second place winner, they'll get a prize. as will the first place winner, and you get bragging rights. I know Zach is offering a free shirt to one of the winners. Julian Cannon, I believe, is offering two shirts to one of the winners. Julian, please let me know. And I'll probably be doing this. I haven't even thought about it, but I'll probably be doing the same. We'll see if someone else wants to offer up a prize. Anybody who's interested can post in the group and let us know. And then we'll figure out who gets what. But that's only for three people chosen at random in the final pool, which I'll either be doing on the Sound Off the week after the Rumble, or, you know what, I was thinking about this. Maybe I might just do a Facebook Live video or something quick the next day and just pick the winner there. You know, do it a day or two later instead of waiting an entire week. And since it's a Facebook pool, I may as well do a Facebook Live video. So we'll see, but let's go number seven. I'm rooting for number seven. For those who have asked me about this, I wanted to just comment on this here. Some people were curious to get my thoughts on this whole YouTube monetization. They changed the rules for YouTube monetization, how that might affect our channel. In short, it shouldn't. Going forward, the rule now is that if you have a YouTube channel that is monetized through Google AdSense, you will need to maintain 4,000 hours of watch time in the past 12 months. And a minimum of 1,000 channel subscribers. Right now, we have almost 31,000 subscribers for our channel, which has all of our... Again, it just houses all of the bonus extra content, not the actual podcast. We have almost 31,000 subs, and in the last 28 days, last I checked, we have over 16,000 hours of view time. And for the last 12 months, it's somewhere around like 19 million minutes, I think it said, or something crazy like that. So we'll be fine. I do feel bad for all the smaller channels who are being burned by this. But the fact is, you know, they're implementing this change because they're worried about losing more advertisers. I mean, that's really what it all boils down to. And they're trying to regain their trust. And so they feel it's long overdue to put these rules in place. And that's all well and good, but, you know, after all this Logan Paul nonsense, and I have been following that, and what a freaking atrocity that whole thing is, I just think it's a bad look for YouTube to strip away monetization for a lot of the smaller content creators out there who are in good standing, unlike other people. I mean, imagine if you have a channel with 500 subscribers, and this happens. This happens more than you would think. You have a channel with sub 1,000 subscribers, 500, 200, whatever it is. But let's say one of your videos happens to go viral. It just, for whatever reason, maybe it's a parody or something, or an interview, and it catches fire. And all of a sudden, it does 1 million, 3 million, 5 million views. With these new rules, you wouldn't be able to make 1 cent off of that video. So you can see why people are so upset about this. It's totally understandable. But as far as our channel, it shouldn't have any impact at all. Audible, still offering everybody a free trial of their service. You guys know the drill, audibletrial.com/solemonster. We had a decent little crush over the last week and a half. I wasn't sure why. Maybe it's the Fire and Fury Michael Wolff book. Maybe it's something else. I don't know. But you can certainly get that free audiobook or any of the other wrestling audiobooks that are on there for free. As part of your 30-day trial, you won't be billed unless you go beyond the 30 days. So if you get to day 29 and you decide, you know what, this isn't for me, you can log in, you can cancel, you won't be billed, but that book that you got for free from us, you get to keep. So audibletrial.com/solemonster, hit that URL, go through the sign-up process, you can get your free book that way. If you want to make a PayPal donation, again, you know the drill. Solemonster.com, PayPal button, right-hand side. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out here on this very podcast. Thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Chuck Lunatic Lentz, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Massgrave Micah Harshaw. Don't forget, you can check out his podcast channel, Movies, a Podcast, on YouTube. YouTube.com/Micah Harshaw. Damn Straight Michael Dorsey, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, The Show Off Corey Van Dam, Canadian Destroyer Rob Morrow, The Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Stephen Foulmouth Fowler, John More Money More Problems Morin, The Warlock Sean Rue, The Chicago Screamer Ian Noel Camelotes, Stephen Handyman Halistic, Faith Hard Knocks Harvey, Smash Mouth Thomas Cochran, Caleb Blackout Brinkman, Jumpin' Jack Rink, Ollie the Ox Vincent, and last but not least, Patrick the Kingpin Beloso. who is the founder and owner of a brand new company called Pin Culture. You can find them at pinculture.com. They are the only pin company in the world that uses a steel bottle opener card instead of a paper pin backer card. They're also the only company with the rights to make Tarzan and John Carter of Mars pins. Check them out at pinculture.com. All right, so with all of that business out of the way, let's talk about this Roman Reigns story, because it got a lot of play this week, and it sounds like much ado about nothing to me. But Roman Reigns, as many of you know by now, was named as a client of a gentleman by the name of Richard Rodriguez, the former owner, co-owner of Iron Addicts Gym in Miami, who has been incarcerated since last summer after he was charged by the federal government with operating a $10 million international steroid ring. Not exactly the sort of thing you want to be associated with if you're Roman Reigns. Rodriguez gave a podcast interview that was floating around on YouTube for a number of days, just sort of sitting there. It's this guy who, I guess, is trying to make a name for himself, and he interviewed the guy from jail, and the interview was online for a few days, and nobody of note touched it, but after a period of a few days, all of a sudden, it just gained steam out of nowhere. And in this interview, Rodriguez cited three names, Roman Reigns being one of them, the other two being actors Josh Duhamel and Mark Wahlberg. Yes, Marky Mark himself, implicated here as clients who I presume allegedly purchased performance-enhancing drugs. Now, as part of the ring, what they were doing was they were importing materials from China, they were making the drugs in Arizona, and then they were shipping them out of Miami. So this was indeed an international operation. He has presented absolutely no evidence whatsoever to prove any of this, at least not yet. All we have to go on so far is the word of this one man whose gym was raided by the DEA and who's currently sitting behind bars. Now, for his part, with websites like Forbes and Bleacher Report picking up the story, Roman Reigns released a statement that reads as follows. He says, "I have never heard of Richard Rodriguez or Wellness Fitness Nutrition," which was his company. "I learned from the mistake that I made nearly 2 years ago and paid the penalty for it. Since then, I've passed 11 tests as part of WWE's independent drug testing program." Now, we don't know what Reigns failed for the first time, because WWE does not release that information. It was sites like The Observer at the time, through their own sources, that reported that the talk in the locker room was that he failed for Adderall and not for anabolic steroids, testosterone, or, you know, anything like that. But the fact is, we still don't know what he failed for. That was never confirmed. That was never corroborated. It still is technically only a rumor that he failed for Adderall. Long story short, I don't want to spend too much more time on this, because until I see some evidence that he knew this guy, or evidence of receipts, records, logs, something like that, I choose to believe Roman Reigns over some drug dealer sitting behind bars. I know the Roman Reigns hate, there's very passionate hate for this man, but I think you've got to be a little nutty if you're going to believe some guy sitting behind bars who we really... Not only do we not know a whole hell of a lot about this guy, but what we do know makes him out to be one of the more shadier characters out there. So besides all of the illegal stuff that he is alleged to have done, right? Here's a guy who was released on I think it was $300,000 bond, okay, last year. He asked the court for permission to travel to California for an interview with NBC Sports as a consultant. And he was also, while he was out there, he claimed he was going to meet with a lawyer about helping him with his case, right? So he bonds out. And he's going to travel to California for these two things as promised. The only thing is, the prosecutors claimed that there was no interview with NBC. The NBC executive that he claimed he was meeting with, I guess, talked to the prosecutors and said that there was never any interview scheduled. He simply gave the guy his business card when they were sitting next to each other on a flight. He gave him his business card to be nice. And that lawyer that he was supposed to be meeting with, he was locked up himself at the time in a federal jail in Brooklyn for plotting to fly 1,500 kilos of cocaine into the country. So this guy sounds like quite the con man. I'm not about to take his word over Roman Reigns, but I will say this. Roman better hope that there is nothing out there linking him to this guy, because it's one thing to deny doing anything improper. I didn't do what I'm alleged to have done. I didn't buy steroids. I didn't, I was never a client of this guy. Yeah, it's one thing to deny doing anything improper like that, but he took it one step further in his statement. And he claimed that he's never even heard of this guy before. So if we come to find out that he did know him, it casts doubt on everything that Roman says. But right now, we have no reason to doubt the guy. This is a non-story until I see a reason to believe otherwise. Meanwhile, Roman's cousin, Jey Uso, was arrested last Sunday in Hidalgo, Texas for DWI, driving while intoxicated. I won't make the obligatory Uso penitentiary joke because 5,000 other people already beat me to it. He was pulled over by a trooper around 2 o'clock in the morning for failing to use his turn signal. When a trooper pulled him over, I guess Uso, he appeared to be intoxicated. He had a strong odor of an alcoholic beverage emitting from his breath, and he was booked. Later on, he was released on $500 bond. He could have his license suspended. He could potentially face jail time, but I think that sounds very unlikely. It is his first offense. We don't even know what his blood alcohol level was. That hasn't, as far as I could tell, that hasn't been released yet. He didn't get pulled over for swerving all over the road. He didn't get pulled over for running a red light. But he just didn't use his turn signal. I mean, how many people among us have forgotten sometimes to use our turn signal? That's what he got pulled over for. WWE released a statement saying Joshua Fatu is responsible for his own personal actions. We are investigating the matter and awaiting information from local law enforcement officials. Unless his blood alcohol was just off the charts, I can't see this amounting to much. You know, for all we know, he had one drink and had beer breath from it. I mean, we don't know. Okay, we don't know. But still, when you're in the public eye like he is, you got to be more careful about these things. Because you know how WWE can react to this, right? I mean, if this is all they have on him, I doubt that it impacts the Usos one way or the other. Like, whether they keep the titles or they lose the titles at the Royal Rumble, I don't think is going to really be affected by this at all, if this is all they have. But still, you got to be more careful. You know the WWE, they're all about PR. You know they hate stories like this, right? Rich Swann hasn't been seen since his little incident last month because they're still waiting to see if charges are going to be filed in that case. You know, Triple H and Stephanie, a couple weeks ago, they're on record as saying that if charges end up being filed against Swann, you know, even if in the end they end up being dismissed, if they file charges against him, he will immediately be terminated by the company. They made that very clear. They do not want to be associated with any behavior like that at all. They're very sensitive to that. You don't ever want to give the cops a reason to charge you with anything. Because one wrong move, one slip up, and that could be the end of your career. And this is actually, it's kind of a timely story because just this week, I was reading a story the other day, there was a government panel that recommended that states lower their blood alcohol content level, threshold, whatever, to try to reduce drunk driving deaths. Under the current law, in every state, if your blood alcohol content is 0.08%, that's considered legally impaired and you can be charged with a crime if you get behind the wheel of a car. They recommend, this panel recommends, lowering that from 0.08% to 0.05%, which I believe the state of Utah just did, although that doesn't actually go into effect until the end of the year. So technically speaking, still as of today, every single state has that blood alcohol threshold of 0.08%. What gets me to 0.05% might be very different than what gets a 6'2", 250-pound pro wrestler to 0.05%. So if this one day were to become the law of the land in all 49 other states, they'll have to be even more careful, you know, before they get behind the wheel to drive to the next town. Because these guys are always on the road. They're always traveling. They're always driving someplace. And, you know, boys will be boys, that whole mentality. So, you know, look, I'm not sure that's such a bad thing either. I mean, it's not for me to say one way or the other, 0.08, 0.05. You know, they have panels that examine and research these things. And I would think that drunk driving deaths are some of the most preventable deaths in the entire country. And there might be people listening to this right now who either directly or indirectly have been affected by that, who probably, you know, would encourage them to lower that level even further. But that's just something that these guys have to be mindful of going forward. WWE made it official this week. Bill Goldberg will be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame, class of 2018, WrestleMania weekend in New Orleans. ESPN.com noted that it was at the Superdome in New Orleans where Goldberg played his very first NFL game as a member of the Atlanta Falcons, and now here he will be there at WrestleMania when they trot out the Hall of Famers for their annual segment, which is, it's kind of like a cool little coming full circle type story for Goldberg. This is all coming off a run last year that made him and WWE a whole bunch of money. Goldberg is back in their good graces. They've mended fences and they're running out of big names to put into the Hall of Fame. I mean, obviously you'll always have The Rock and The Undertaker and Big Show and Kane and Chris Jericho. So, you know, in the future they'll have a bunch of names, but I don't see any of those guys retiring anytime soon. I mean, Undertaker should be, but in the meantime, they're always looking for big, big names to headline with, and there aren't really that many of them. So Goldberg made a lot of sense. And look, everybody has their own criteria for who should be in and who shouldn't be in. There is no set criteria. It is not, in that sense, a legitimate Hall of Fame, if you want to look at it that way. There is no handwritten criteria for who gets in and who doesn't. There's no real benchmark. You don't even have to have worked in WWE. They've inducted people who were stars in other promotions in other countries. You know, so everybody is right. If your opinion is Goldberg should be in, you're right. If your opinion is Goldberg should not be in, well, I guess you're right too, because there is no set criteria for it. I think he deserves to be in as much as anybody. He was white hot at WCW's peak. One of only a couple of legitimate stars they made during that Monday Night War period. He had that 1 year in WWE where he won the world title. He beat Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania. And then the most recent run with Brock and another WrestleMania match. He deserves to be in. And if it were me, I would go with either DDP or Eric Bischoff to do the induction. DDP because he gave Goldberg the best match of his career at Halloween Havoc back in 98. But according to The Observer, as of right now, it looks like Paul Heyman will be the one doing the induction. Because I guess they both spin dreidels on Hanukkah. I don't know. I guess Barry Horowitz must be busy that day. But they probably just looked at Heyman and said, hey, we have something in common between these two guys. Let's have Heyman do the induction. Although, hey, to be fair to Goldberg, if I was going to have somebody induct me into the Hall of Fame, Paul Heyman probably would be near the top of my list. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. I just thought it was an odd choice. I know he managed Lesnar, so they were sort of indirectly, you know, him and Goldberg were sort of indirectly feuding last year. So there is a tie-in there, I guess. But I still think that's a bit odd to have Heyman be the one to do it. But whatever. What I found hilarious, though, was the press release that WWE put out about his induction, which included this quote from one Paul Levesque, okay, in the most boilerplate of boilerplate public relations quotes that you'll ever see. And if you're in PR, you know what I mean. Goldberg's unique athleticism, persona, and intensity captured the imagination of sports entertainment fans around the world and throughout his illustrious career. We are honored to have Goldberg take his rightful place in the WWE Hall of Fame. That is quite the turnaround from 7 years ago when he made the case against putting Goldberg into the Hall of Fame by saying, among other things, we try to honor the guys who deserve it. That is a direct quote from Triple H. Well then, there were dirt sheet stories at the time that flat out said Triple H and Shawn Michaels both were lobbying against Goldberg being even considered for the Hall of Fame when they were doing WrestleMania in Atlanta. There was talk of maybe doing a WCW class because they were in their old stomping grounds. Goldberg's name came up, and the stories at the time alleged that it was Triple H and Shawn Michaels who were lobbying against it. Actively lobbying against, this would have been back probably in 2011, which actually I think is the year Shawn Michaels went in. But that interview that he and Shawn Michaels gave to SB Nation all those years, it was like, again, 7 years ago, pretty much cemented what their thoughts were about Bill Goldberg. And in all fairness to Triple H, in that same interview, he made some valid points in that interview. It wasn't just like a total hit job or anything like that. Let's bury Goldberg. He made other points when he was talking about there being other guys at the time who had not been inducted, who he thought should go in first. He name-dropped Bruno Sammartino, who did eventually go in, thanks to Triple H. He also cited how short Goldberg's run was as the case for why he may not deserve to go into the Hall of Fame, which, again, if it was some kind of system based on tenure, you had to have a certain number of years in the business. And you can make that case, but given some of the names they put into this Hall of Fame and the celebrities, to me, that's not an excuse. You can't use tenure as an excuse. Shawn Michaels was a little more direct at the time with his feelings. He said, to me, Goldberg's not even in the ballpark. In our line of work, there are other qualities that make somebody viable besides just whether or not they're tough or not. And he's right. I would offer qualities like, oh, I don't know, drawing power. Shawn Michaels may have had a longer career than Goldberg did, but at his peak, there is no way that Shawn Michaels was anywhere close to the kind of draw that Goldberg was, or that he made more money than Goldberg did for WCW for that year or two, whatever it was. There's no way. Shawn Michaels is one of the greatest of all time. He's part of the greatest, in my opinion, WrestleMania match of all time. His career, his body of work speaks for itself. I'm not knocking that. But you can't tell me that at their respective peaks that he was more of a draw than Bill Goldberg was. He wasn't. And I would like to think that Shawn Michaels has evolved his views on the Hall of Fame in the last 7 years. Maybe he just has something against homegrown WCW guys. You know, hopefully he won't sleep through Goldberg's Hall of Fame speech the way he did DDP's last year. Let's talk about Raw. Speaking of Shawn Michaels, Raw was in San Antonio, Texas last Monday. Over 2,300 votes in our Twitter poll, which is more than usual, way more than usual for just a regular episode of Raw. 69% thumbs up, 31% thumbs down. More votes than usual actually makes sense, given that Raw's ratings were way up this week with no football. They were up to around like 3.2 million viewers, I think. So more people watching Raw, more people voting in our poll. The latest additions to the Raw 25 lineup. I'm genuinely excited about this show tomorrow night. I've not been this excited about an episode of Raw in probably years. Although the post-WrestleMania Raws were always a lot of fun, so, you know, the post-Mania Raws, especially the ones I've been to, are almost always fun. But those aside, I can't think of another Raw I've looked forward to this much in a very long time. So kudos to them for making this a must-see show. WWE accidentally leaked the opening video to tomorrow night's show. They immediately took it down, but the internet works very fast, and so people were able to grab it before it got pulled. I watched it. It's very well done. That's about 3.5-4 minutes long. It's very well done. I'm not going to say any more than that. I don't want to spoil it for anybody as far as who they show and the moments they show, but it's very well put together. I saw just a little while ago they put the whole video back up. It's at least on their Twitter. They linked to it. So they must have figured, well, we leaked it already anyway. We may as well just show people. So it's already online, officially, from WWE themselves. If you want to watch it, you can do so. And if you want to wait and get the whole experience tomorrow night and just wait until the show goes on the air and watch it, then you can do that as well. I might be recording a Sound Off Extra. In fact, I'm pretty sure I will be recording a Sound Off Extra review for Raw 25, like I would do for most pay-per-views. And that would go up late Monday night, early Tuesday morning, like the pay-per-view review videos normally do. That would be exclusive to the YouTube channel. Although the link, as always, would be in the video description if you want to grab the MP3. I just figured, you know, instead of waiting until next Sunday, because next Sunday's show is already going to be a packed show, too. I've got Royal Rumble predictions to do, any last-minute Rumble news. That's episode 532, plus my NXT TakeOver review will be on that show. So there'll be plenty to talk about next weekend. I might just go ahead and give you guys my Raw thoughts early this week. So that's just something to watch out for, and another reason to subscribe to the YouTube channel. So you might want to get on that. But this is the current most up-to-date list of all of the legends, all of the names being brought in for Raw 25 tomorrow night, either at the Barclays Center and or the Manhattan Center. I don't doubt that there's going to be some big names going back and forth, because again, the buildings are only about 6 miles apart. I know New York traffic and all that, but still, if you come out early in the show, you can leave, and then 30 minutes later, you can be at the other building. It's not that big of a deal. Here's the list as of right now. Stone Cold Steve Austin. You can't have a Raw anniversary without Stone Cold, so he'll be there. The Undertaker, we know he'll be there. What he'll be doing is going to be one of the more talked about things going into tomorrow night. Shawn Michaels and Triple H reforming DX, or representing DX, they'll be there. Chris Jericho was added to the list this past week. So Jericho is, he's making the rounds. Now, I would love nothing more than to see Naito run out and beat his ass. I honestly think, you know what, well, maybe not, but I don't know. I feel like somebody like Triple H, if Triple H was in charge, he would at least be open to the idea. But then I think, like, him and Jericho, I mean, I know they, you know, they claim they're all friendly now, but there's still something there. They never did come off as really liking each other very much. But I almost feel like Triple H would be more open to doing something like that if they could come up with a mutually beneficial way to work together. Vince McMahon wouldn't even consider it, but Jericho will be there. Trish Stratus has been announced for the show. Tori Wilson will be there. Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, who are going to be doing the announcing from the Manhattan Center. Jacqueline, the Dudley Boys, who are also rumored for the Hall of Fame this year. Christian will be there. Edge will not be because I think he's out of the country doing something or filming something. Ric Flair will be there. Maria Kanellis will be there. Scott Hall will be there. The Bella Twins, the New Age Outlaws, Eric Bischoff, Terry Runnels. So maybe we will get a little interaction between Terry and Goldust. Ron Simmons and JBL will be there. Kelly Kelly will be there. The Godfather, the Brooklyn Brawler, Michelle McCool, Brother Love, Boogeyman, Teddy Long, the Million Dollar Man, John Laurinaitis, Harvey Whippleman, Lillian Garcia, Jonathan Coachman, MVP, William Regal, and Howard Finkel, who better be doing the ring announcing from the Manhattan Center. That's all I gotta say. So that's the official list, plus Shane McMahon, Daniel Bryan, AJ Styles, Randy Orton, Charlotte, The Usos, and The New Day from SmackDown Live are all expected to be part of the show in some way, shape, or form. One person who will not be there, and I don't think they're working us, one person who I don't think will be there, is Hulk Hogan. Because there's been some talk about Hogan. Is this the time that WWE brings him back? He's been gone now for, what, 4 years, I think? He's basically been exiled. And maybe this is the time, the big Raw anniversary, all the legends, they're going to bring back the Hulkster. Hogan has said he has not been contacted, he's going to be watching from home on TV. Meanwhile, WWE responded to questions about it with a statement saying, at this time, WWE remains committed to its decision. Now, if Hogan were coming back, if it was going to be a surprise, I don't think they would have put that statement out. There's still a lot of people very uneasy about the idea of Hogan coming back. It's a very sensitive subject for a lot of people. I really don't think WWE would put a statement out, voluntarily put a statement out saying we are committed to our decision, and then turn around and say, surprise, and bring the guy back. So I really don't think he will be there. I'm fine with Hulk Hogan coming back, even though I totally understand why some people would not be okay with that and never want to see his face again. But honestly, I mean, as far as this goes, as far as Raw goes, I don't associate Hogan with the Raw era anyway. I mean, he was on one Raw show back in 93, before WrestleMania, didn't even wrestle. He never showed up there again until 2002. And, you know, he had some moments. You know, he pinned The Rock in that handicap match against the NWO against Austin and Rock right before WrestleMania 18. And think about that, taking a match like that, the first ever match with Austin and Hogan in the ring together like that, and they blew it off like on the go-home Raw to WrestleMania. So if you ever want to see Hogan and Austin fighting it out in the ring together, go back to that episode of Raw, because that's the only way you're going to see it. He did have a match once, I think it might have been for the Undisputed title, on Raw against Ric Flair, and then they had that birthday celebration a few years ago, about 4 or 5 years back, where Brock Lesnar came out and called him Grandpa. One of the more memorable Hogan moments on Raw. Actually, I think when The Undertaker dragged him behind the motorcycle, when he flooded The Undertaker's, I guess Harley it would have been, he flooded his motorcycle, couldn't get it to work. That was embarrassing enough. But I remember Undertaker dragging him by a rope behind the motorcycle through the backstage area. Imagine the rug burn he probably had from that. I'm pretty sure that was on Raw too. So actually, Hogan's had a few moments. He's had a few memorable moments on the show. And it's not like they don't have other people like MVP and the Boogeyman coming to the show who... I know MVP was I think, drafted to Raw at one point, but I don't remember them doing jack shit on Raw. But still, if Hogan's going to come back, it should be at WrestleMania. It should be at WrestleMania, the show he helped make in front of a big crowd, coming down to Real American and having the moment all to himself. That's the more appropriate place. If you're going to bring him back, that's the more appropriate place to do it. He doesn't have to be on Raw. I think they should bring him back at Mania this year so he can joke about making sure he calls the Superdome by its correct name this time. Kevin Nash is also off the show. He was originally announced. Now he is off. He is still recovering from a knee replacement last month. I was going to say a knee reconstruction, but it was a knee replacement. So he can't travel. He'll be at WrestleMania. He told everybody, see you in New Orleans. He does the shenanigans party this, sort of the night before WrestleMania every single year, whatever the city is. I've been to it before. It's a lot of fun. A lot of wrestlers show up. So I imagine he'll be there doing another one of those parties in New Orleans this year. But meanwhile, Scott Hall, who I mentioned is on the list, he is going to be there tomorrow night. Scott Hall was a guest on Sean Waltman's podcast, someone else who I believe is going to be there tomorrow. And he said that WWE texted him to bring your ring gear to Raw tomorrow night. Now, I hear that and I think to myself, look, I think it's great that Scott Hall got his life back together and DDP is just an amazing miracle worker for doing that. But what kind of physical shape is Scott Hall in? He is older now. He does have other health issues. He's got a pacemaker, for God's sakes. So I don't know physically. I haven't seen him recently. I don't know what he looks like in his old ring gear. Maybe I don't want to know. But we just don't. We just don't know. That being said, okay, maybe I end up being completely wrong about this and I take one look at the guy and I'm like, oh boy. But I think they should bring it all full circle and do a quick little match with him as Razor Ramon and Waltman as the 1-2-3 kid. And Waltman still wrestles indies and actually is in pretty damn good shape. So him pulling off the 1-2-3 kid thing one more time is a non-issue. The issue more is Hall than anything else. But they don't have to do a full-blown match. They do their entrances. You do it at the Manhattan Center. I think for nostalgia purposes, and you do like a very quick little match between them. I wouldn't have a problem with that at all. I actually think that would be kind of cool. Now, they're bringing in so many people for this show that there's talk that maybe there's just going to be a big, like, Legends Battle Royal, similar to what they did with the Gimmick Battle Royal at WrestleMania X7, which, as a match, bad as it was, I enjoyed the hell out of that. I mean, that WrestleMania show, top to bottom, is still the best Mania to this day. It does make sense. There's so many names they're bringing in. You think to yourself, even on a 3-hour show with all the commercial breaks and all the hype for the Rumble, oh, by the way, they have a pay-per-view to promote next Sunday. How in God's name are you going to fit all these people in unless you just have this one photo op segment where they're all just sort of standing in the ring? A battle royal would make a lot of sense. So maybe instead of one-on-one, you put Waltman in there as the 1-2-3 kid and you have Hall come out to the Razor Ramon theme. Believe me, people would mark the hell out if Scott Hall came out one last time dressed up as Razor Ramon. Like, come on. So I'm hoping for that. I really am. And look, the whole night is built on nostalgia. That's what it is. So, everybody has their own idea of what they'd like to see and who they'd like to see and who they want to see wrestle. Maybe The Undertaker is coming back, not to come back at WrestleMania. Maybe he's just coming back to recreate the main event against Damian Demento. We don't know. And actually, I'd be okay with that, as long as he doesn't wrestle at WrestleMania. I wouldn't be okay with that. He shouldn't be wrestling. I'm seeing rumblings that WWE may be making the announcement as early as this week, if not the week after, about the location for WrestleMania 35 next year. The New York, New Jersey area and Philadelphia are the two areas being talked about the most. So you better bundle up either way, because it may be a cold one next year. But interestingly, I see Citi Field being mentioned if it's in New York, not necessarily MetLife Stadium where they had WrestleMania 29, which is in New Jersey, but I've seen Citi Field. All of a sudden on social media, people are talking about Citi Field, which is the home of my New York Mets. It is a smaller stadium, a newer one, but a smaller one. They fit about 41, 42,000 for Mets games, although it's been a long fucking time before you had 42,000 people in that stadium, given how awful this team has been. I imagine they could probably fit, several thousand more for a wrestling show. I don't know how I feel about that. I don't think it's going to be Citi Field. I think it's just a rumor at this point, nothing more. But I don't even know how to feel about that. The area around there is kind of a dump with all the chop shops they got in the area. I use WrestleMania as my vacation every year. I want to get away from New York. You know, like, I'm in New York, you know, 12 months out of the year, save for the 1 week or whatever it is when I go to whatever city Mania is in. And a vacation in Queens, you know, no offense to all you Queens people, doesn't seem very appealing to me. So selfishly, I'm kind of hoping it's not in New York. Philly would make sense with it being 20 years next year since WrestleMania was last in Philadelphia. That was WrestleMania 15 at the peak of the Attitude Era. That, and I saw the logo floating around for WrestleMania with the Liberty Bell in the logo. It looks like a legitimate logo, and I know there are some very talented people with their Photoshop skills. This thing looks pretty realistic to me. So, if it is in Philly, this logo seems like, you know, it would make a lot of sense. Because they don't assign numbers anymore in the logos. Like, it's WrestleMania Play Button. It's WrestleMania Sun. In Dallas, it was WrestleMania Star. What was it last year? WrestleMania Palm Tree or something? So now it's WrestleMania Bell. It's like, they don't do numbers anymore. They do little logos. Little emojis for the WrestleMania logo. What they should have done for that WrestleMania a few years ago. What was it? 32 should have been the WrestleMania with the poop emoji. But anyway, we'll know soon enough. I only want Mania back in Philly if they promise to bring back the WrestleMania Rage Party like they did back in 99. Remember that? Remember the shot of Vince McMahon dancing to Chocolate Salty Balls as Isaac Hayes hit the ivories and played the song, big concert. It was just this big party that they put together. That's what the whole Attitude Era was meant to be. It was like one big friggin' party. And there's a shot of even Shane. I don't know if Shane was under the influence of something or what was wrong with him. He was acting weird. But Vince is just, you got to see this. You got to go back. It's on YouTube. Find the part. It's early on because Vince comes out early in the party. And then Isaac Hayes starts playing Chocolate Salty Balls. And they get this shot of Vince McMahon. He looks like he's clucking like a chicken. Or maybe he's like morphing. He's in the middle of like a metamorphosis or something into a chicken. What was the story? Jim Ross in his book, I think, when he first meets Vince and Vince is driving him. I don't know if they're leaving the office maybe on Ross's first day or something, but they're in Vince's car and Vince is like driving like a madman and he's playing, I don't know if it's like rap music or something. And he makes the comment to JR like, I dance pretty well for a white guy. Like, that's just Vince. And you see him dance in that video. And by the way, I can attest just watching that video that he, in fact, he is not necessarily a great dancer. But then again, he did the, what was it, Stand Back, right? That whole Stand Back video at the Slammies all those years ago. He is an amazing man. You can say what you want to about how senile he's going in his old age, but he is, put it this way, there will never be another Vince McMahon. And there's a lot of good to that. There's a lot of bad to that. I think his dancing skills might fall under the bad more than the good. But my guess is that if it is Philly, we'll get the announcement next weekend because the Royal Rumble happens to be in Philadelphia next weekend. And so it would make sense for it to coincide with that. I'll tell you one thing I know. Wherever it ends up, I'm pretty sure it will not be an international city. I've heard nothing about, you know, London or, you know, anywhere in the UK, anything like that. And so you know what that means. If you've listened to the show for any extended period of time, you know what that means. That means I win the bet. And Noah Mark owes me a steak dinner this year in New Orleans. That was the bet that we made in Miami over WrestleMania 28 weekend. He bet that WWE would have its first WrestleMania in the UK or some other international city by WrestleMania 35. Okay, we made that bet the weekend of 28. He said by 35, they'll hit some international city, some like the UK, I think was actually what the bet was for. And I said, no, they're not. So I like my steak medium rare. You can add Jason Jordan to the list of the walking wounded. He's dealing with some sort of injury. WWE hasn't said what. He was on the show last Monday and involved. He didn't wrestle. He was also held off all of the house shows this weekend. So even honorary members of the Shield now are getting hurt. That reunion was cursed from the moment they did it. Hopefully it's nothing too serious. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for Samoa Joe. WWE has been quiet about him as well, but according to The Observer, he is out of the Royal Rumble match with a foot injury, the one that I talked about last week. So I guess he will not be eliminating John Cena as his first elimination, as he promised. And not only is he out of the Rumble, but he is off all of the show lineups at least through the middle of March. That puts him perilously close to missing WrestleMania this year, which would be his first. If you remember, he was left off the WrestleMania card last year, even though he was already up on the main roster. He was left off the Mania card because they did Seth Rollins against Triple H instead of doing Rollins and Joe, or at least you could even have Joe. He was kind of Triple H's hired gun. I'm not even sure why Joe didn't either interfere or, you know, sitting ringside in his corner. He had no involvement at all in the show whatsoever. He just was left off. And I think with the run that he's been on the last several months, he needs to be on that show. Whatever the role may be. I mean, I do think it would be a waste to just, you know, put him in an Andre Battle Royal or something. If he's going to be in there, at least, you know, have him win it. But he really deserves to be on that show. And hopefully he's not out too much longer than that and he can make the cut. Raw is Braun. That was sort of the title, I guess, the working title of the show from last Monday. That was the theme of Monday Night Raw last week. They ran a show-long storyline where Kurt Angle fired Braun Strowman for nearly murdering Brock Lesnar and Kane the week before and creating what he called an unsafe work environment. Kurt was nice enough to wait an entire week until they were back on TV to announce this, presumably paying Braun for the extra week before firing him. Which begs the question, if the place was so unsafe with him there, why not fire him before flying him out to the show? These are the things I wonder about. From there, Strowman terrorized everybody. He beat up a bunch of security guards. He said he wasn't leaving until everybody gets these hands. He's like a masseuse now. That could be his new gimmick. He stormed through catering where there was a guy randomly holding a chocolate cake, which Strowman took a chunk out of before walking off. I guess that's one of the perks of working in WWE. When you're backstage, you get random chocolate cake, I guess. A stagehand later on walked into Kurt Angle's office, his mangled office that Braun had destroyed, and he told him Braun's heading for the production truck, and in one of the hokiest reactions that I have ever seen. Kurt paused for about 2 seconds, and then suddenly panicked. He claimed, oh, that, my God, that's worth $12 million! And he stormed off. I think I enjoyed this angle more for the absurdity of it all and the comedy of it, as opposed to how serious I think it was probably intended to be. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I was at least entertained by most of it. At least until we got to the part where he tipped the truck over. Strowman did head for the TV truck, probably looking for Kevin Dunn for all those damn camera cuts that we get every single week. We did actually get a rare Kevin Dunn on-air appearance. Some people were asking me, where was he? Was he on the show? Yes, he was. Kevin Dunn was on Raw Monday night. If you watch closely, he was one of the crew members who ran for his life out of the truck when Strowman came in. Then he left the truck, and that's when he overturned another truck. There was like a big rig. I think maybe the production truck was attached to it or something. Anyway, he exits the production truck. He ends up tipping over this giant rig, and they edited this so much. They had so many camera cuts. I don't know how I didn't vomit watching this. This is where they went off the rails with this whole angle. Like, nobody believes that he could actually flip that truck over. No amount of camera cuts can distract us from that fact. But that's what they do sometimes. They take an angle that's good in concept, but then they just go too far with it. And that's when it turns into comedy more than anything else. And people just sort of like, I can't even, you know, this is unbelievable. I can't believe this. So then Braun goes back into the arena and he walks over to the announcer's desk. And Booker T sort of redeemed this entire thing by sacrificing Michael Cole, very blatantly shoving Cole into harm's way to save himself as Braun approached. Booker T is all of us. Don't tell me you wouldn't have done the exact same thing. I know I would have. So Braun threatened to kill Michael Cole. Kurt Angle comes out with a bunch of referees. He's trying to talk some sense into Strowman. He tells Braun, hey, Stephanie McMahon, who apparently inexplicably called and rehired Braun, he's explaining to Braun, Stephanie called and rehired you. You're reinstated. And you're back in the championship match at the Royal Rumble. And Strowman tried to kill Cole anyway. Tossed him onto a pile of security guards, and the safest bump that I think has ever been taken, maybe in the 25 years that Raw has been on the air. Linda McMahon took a scarier bump than Michael Cole did when she took a tombstone on stage from Kane. This looked awful. Why even do it at all? That's what I say. I'm not saying that Michael Cole should risk his life and do something like this dangerous spot, throw him off the stage onto the concrete. I'm not saying that. But for God's sakes, I mean, you got to think these things through here. I would much rather they just not do this at all than do something that just looks incredibly fake. By the way, when Kurt came out and mentioned Stephanie's name, he called her Stephanie McCran, not McMahon. Stephanie McCran reinstated Braun Strowman. Kurt Angle should be forced to undergo neurological testing before he is allowed to wrestle again. Fortunately for them, Tom Phillips just so happened to be on standby in the back. They were able to pull him away from social media for a few minutes to fill in for Michael Cole, who is still recovering from landing gently on top of eight other men. This whole angle was just goofy as hell, but the people were behind Strowman like a superstar, so I think it was effective. Again, I think it went a little too far, but I think it was effective overall. I just hope that Stephanie reinstating Strowman is not just a way to set up something with him and Triple H for WrestleMania. I will admit, off the top of my head here, if Strowman's not challenging for the championship, which I'm sure he isn't, I'm not sure what you do with Braun Strowman. And now Joe is out hurt. He may not even be at Mania. So what do you do with Braun? Him and Triple H would at least be a big match. It's just not a match that I can really get all that excited about. You know, especially when I think back to the little interaction they had at Survivor Series, which seemed to be setting up something. I can't say I'm honestly excited by that match. So I hope that's not just the setup for that. Asuka beat Nia Jax by ref stoppage when Nia couldn't put any weight on her leg that Asuka had been working over. This was good. I thought they had a good match. I thought crowd was behind Nia a lot more than I expected, maybe even more than Asuka, which, you know, I'm all for heel Asuka. So if that's the direction they want to go, keep her undefeated a little while longer and build to a babyface beating her, I'm fine with that. I think the longer they keep her undefeated, the greater the chance of the fans turning against her anyway. You know, why end the streak now? Why not use it to get heat on her? The Revival beat two jobbers and cut a promo after the match talking about how they're not sports entertainers, they're professional wrestlers, which got them some cheers. They also crapped all over the legends that are coming to Raw 25 tomorrow night. And it was very obvious that they're setting up these guys to be kind of like what Heath Slater was to the legends leading up to Raw 1000 6 years ago. Being set up as the fall guys, the sacrificial lambs for all the older guys. What's weird is that their promos seem to be designed to get them booed. I had just the opposite reaction. I applauded them for talking about wrestling and being wrestlers. And it's just funny to me that to Vince McMahon, that qualifies as a heel tactic. Two things that Tom Phillips said on this show that made me laugh. One, he said somehow with a straight face, he said this, wins and losses are everything in WWE, which is just comical on so many levels. And after the main event, he said the referee's decision, because there was some ref controversy. The referee's decision, according to Tom Phillips on this show, is always final in WWE. He said this, 2 weeks after Chad Gable and Shelton Benjamin saw their tag team title win reversed by the referee on SmackDown, the same show where he does the play-by-play? I told you, they think we're idiots. All of us. Every last one of us. They think we're a bunch of morons. Seth Rollins against Finn Balor. I thought these two had a great match. Rollins came off the top for a frog splash. I think it was a frog splash, but Balor got the knees up, turned it into a pin attempt with a cradle. Confusion ensued when it looked as if the referee had counted three. He was going to count four. People thought, oh, Balor won, but in fact, he had only counted two. Two count only, he said. Now, they did show a replay of what happened after the match. And I got to stick up for the referee here. There was no four. What is with all this talk? Oh, there was a four count. The referee botched it was a four count. There was no four count. There's no four count. If you watch the replay, you could blame the referee for being a little out of position. But he clearly went to go count one. He hesitated because he didn't have a good view of Seth's shoulder. He moved back just a little bit, And then he began counting. But everyone's like, oh, he counted three. He was counting four. No, he wasn't. He counted two. There was no three. There was no three. The only thing he's guilty of is being out of position. So the match continued. Jason Jordan reached in. He tripped up Finn Balor, which led to people losing their minds when Rollins dusted off the old curb stomp for the win. Corey Graves called it the blackout. They never once mentioned the curb stomp name, which is seemingly still banned. The name, not the move. It appears the move itself has been unbanned, which, thank God. I mean, how many months has it been since that stupid knee that Seth's been using has even had an official name? It was the Kingslayer, and then it was something else, and then it was just the knee. For the longest time, Michael, oh, he hit the knee. He hit the knee. It sounded ridiculous. At least now he's got his move back. People are happy. It got a great reaction, and it looked brutal. I mean, it actually, poor Finn Balor, it looked like he got his bell, like, legitimately rung on the move. So watch him turn around now and ban it again after 1 week. But it's funny, you know, on WWE.com, they only refer to it as a move we've seen him use to win many big matches. I hope they call it that. I hope they call it that. So when he hits it at WrestleMania, Michael Cole is forced to say that whole sentence. Oh, he hit the move. We've seen him win many big matches. What? That could be its official name. So that was Raw. Alberto El Patron. Let me talk about this guy here. Alberto was back in the news this week. And you know nothing good can come from a sentence like that. Alberto El Patron was back in the news. That nothing good can come from that. He gave an interview to a Spanish news website called Medio Tiempo. And he expressed an interest in returning to WWE for one last run before he retires next year, claiming that he has apologized to Triple H for all of the bad things that he said about him. He said, I apologize to Triple H for the issues that we were in when I was with the relationship with my ex-partner, that being Paige, who he doesn't name. But this is what he said about her. This is unbelievable. So he says, you know, the issues that I was in when I was in that relationship, she and her entire family made me believe that those who affected our relationship were them, specifically him. Of course I would go back to WWE. I would not go back full time, but I would make a special appearance, and it will surely happen before I retire. I will do something special with them. Before leaving in 2019, I'm definitely going to do something with them. We shook hands, and everything is fine now. Time heals all wounds. So that's from Alberto. Bret Hart got screwed in 1997, right? Punched Vince McMahon in the face. That bad blood simmered for over a decade. Very little communication between the two sides. A lot of angst, a lot of bad feelings, a lot of bad blood. Now, Bret did come back for the Hall of Fame. So he did come back for that. But beyond that, never came back. Never showed up on TV again. Even when he went into the Hall of Fame, he didn't even show up. He flew himself home before WrestleMania the next day. Okay? Over a decade before he finally returned to the company. It was 12 years. From the last time Bret appeared on Raw to the time that he returned. That's an example of time healing all wounds. It was only 6 months ago that this guy was calling Triple H a pussy with a big nose and no balls. And threatening to beat the shit out of him at his restaurant. Which has since been shut down. That's not to say anything of the half a dozen other times that he was drunk off his ass in those Periscope videos, calling Triple H all sorts of names. That was only last year. Time heals all wounds, he says. Well, hey, if Triple H did meet the guy and shake his hand, then he's a better man than I am. He's a businessman. He's doing what's best for business. Or is he? Or is he? Because I don't think bringing back Alberto Del Rio would mean a whole hell of a lot to that company's bottom line. I really don't. Here's what I think is going on here. I think that Alberto realizes that Anthem is probably not going to be able to keep him at the salary that he's been making when his contract expires, which is why that they've parted ways recently with guys like EC3 and Bobby Lashley, who were making good money. They couldn't pay him anymore. So those guys are gone. And I think he probably sees the writing on the wall. He won't have that cushy spot anymore. He won't have that cushy contract. Plus, his restaurant failed, and he sees his window to make real money closing, rapidly closing. He's not getting any younger. He's 40 years old. And so he decides to blame Paige and her family for him behaving like a jackass. That's the richest part of that whole statement. He's putting the blame on Paige for brainwashing him. That's why he went on Periscope all those times, even when Paige was in the background trying to desperately trying to get him to put his phone down because she was still working for the company at the time. And here's this guy going, you know, the guy with the big nose, the big pussy over there who works for that company I won't name. And this poor girl's in the background. She's like got her head in her hands. She's trying to turn away. She is so embarrassed by him every single time in every single one of those videos. Despite that, it was all her fault. Wasn't his fault. It was all her fault. All those Impact Zone tapings where he would grab the microphone and do nothing but rant about WWE when he was their champion. He was the Impact World Champion at the time. But all he could ever talk about, all that would ever leave his lips, was WWE. I guess some things never change, apparently. Here's another example of it. He's still working for Impact. He's giving interviews talking about wanting to go back to WWE. I'm sure Anthem must be thrilled to see that one of their top stars, making more money than maybe anybody else on that roster at this point, is so openly talking about wanting to go back to WWE. I'm sure that just delights them to no end. Now, I'm not saying Paige is any kind of angel or was any kind of angel in that relationship. They both seem very screwed up, okay? But to play the victim card now, after talking about how awful it was to work there. Oh my God, WWE, what an awful place to work. And again, all the stuff about Triple H and all. He never really bashed Vince. It seems like he and Vince have had a friendship that he, you know, has been maintained. It was always Triple H that he would attack. And the company in general. Not so much Vince McMahon. But after all of the things that he said, all that stuff, bashing them at every single turn for over a year, now he's trying to get back into WWE. Let me tell you something. If WWE takes this guy back, they're even dumber than he is. SmackDown Live from Laredo, Texas this past week. Twitter poll, over 1,600 votes. 53% thumbs up, 47% thumbs down. We went from having the United States Championship Tournament finals at the Royal Rumble. That was the original plan, right? They were going to have the finals of the Rumble. To having them on the go-home show to the Royal Rumble, to just saying, ah, fuck it, and doing it this past Tuesday instead. Okay, then. The bad news is that we got not one, but two Jinder Mahal matches on the same show. Over half an hour's worth of Jinder Mahal matches. I thought his match with Xavier Woods was awful. I thought it was dreadfully boring. 18 minutes this thing went. Bobby Roode then beat Mojo Rawley in a match that really wasn't much better. Beat him with the glorious DDT to advance to the finals. This is where Tom Phillips tried to set up Roode's entrance theme when he came out by leaving his sentence hanging and letting the music finish the sentence. When the music goes glorious, he was going to let the music say it. But instead, Byron Saxton jumped in and ruined it. And Phillips called him out on it. Way to go, Byron. The Singh brothers attacked Roode after the match. Roode was selling a rib injury, but still, he offered to wrestle Jinder tonight. After Jinder started talking smack about him from the aisleway, he goes, hey, why don't we just do it tonight? You know, and how many times do we see that, right? Usually, like 6 days before a pay-per-view, or 5 days in this case, SmackDown would be on a Tuesday, pay-per-view would be on a Sunday. How many times have we seen people go, I don't want to wait until Sunday, let's do it tonight, and all the sheep, they all fall for it, they all cheer, yay, let's see it tonight, yay! And then, of course, the heel goes, nah, fuck you. We'll do it on my terms, on my time, not when you say. And so I figured, okay, it's more of the same here. We're getting the same stuff as we always get. And I will say that it was a nice little swerve here, because they, in fact, did give us exactly what the fans wanted to see. The fans wanted to see the finals that night. Jinder said no. Daniel Bryan came out and said, yes, we are going to have the finals tonight. And everybody cheered. And I'll get to that in a second, the finals here. The Usos did appear on this show, off the news of Jey Uso's DWI arrest. Dasha Bot interviewed them backstage. She actually showed a little more life here than usual. So someone must have given her a RAM upgrade. They speculated that Gable and Benjamin became a team by joining Tag Team Tinder, which sounds like something completely different than what they were actually talking about, and not an entirely bad idea. Gable and Benjamin attacked them both from behind and left them laying. A very tame attack. This was nothing like they, you know, hit them with chairs or anything like that. Now, I mention this because they were laying there, right? After this extremely conservative attack, very tame, okay? And they started to collect themselves and get back up to their feet. One of the referees on scene starts calling for help. Help! We need help! 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 I'm like, do you? Do you really? They got hit from behind, no different than they would in any match. Why do they need help? What, did they hit them from behind with tire irons? Did they swing a cinder block at their skulls? You would think these two had been shot. You're there. What do you need help for? And not 5 seconds after he calls for help, they were back on their feet anyway. Throughout the show, they had all the men in the Royal Rumble match and all the women in the Ladies Rumble cutting their own selfie promos on their phones. I guess this is the new age version of those old Royal Rumble promos guys would cut before the match, which I used to love. So I appreciate them bringing it back, even if I hate the way they're doing it, but at least they are. I will say, Shinsuke Nakamura, you guys know I like Shinsuke. And I would love to see what he and AJ can do at WrestleMania. I really would. But man, are his promos the shits. Man, are his promos the shits. At least it was short. He said, I think he said, 30 men, one winner, me. Let's rumble. Short and to the point. But, you know, that stupid mouth guard that he has in his mouth, even when he's not wrestling, that probably doesn't help. Like, it's not the guy, like, English is not the guy's first language to begin with. Why would you keep your mouthpiece in when you're cutting promos? Maybe that has something to do with it, but I don't know. I feel like you can be a Shinsuke fan, but just call him out for what it is. I mean, we already knew it wasn't his strong suit to begin with, and that's fine, but man, this has not been good when I've seen him speak lately. Main event was the finals of the U.S. title tournament between Bobby Roode and Jinder Mahal. This was at least a little bit better than the earlier matches they both had in the show. Roode sold his ribs for most of it. Jinder went for the Colossus, but Roode slipped out, very smoothly countered it into the glorious DDT for the clean win. I did like the finish. I thought it was well done. Very surprised by the Bobby Roode win. I thought they'd put that title on Jinder. I thought they set things up for it with the Bobby Roode injury. They could use that as an excuse for why he lost. But they went the other way, and I'm A-okay with that. Daniel Bryan and Shane McMahon came out to celebrate with Roode to end the show. Good for Bobby Roode. It's good to see him in a spot like that. But this show sucked. Plain and simple, I thought this show sucked. I really didn't like it. And I don't know what's going on with SmackDown lately. It's kind of hit or miss. More miss than hit. It doesn't always suck. A lot of weeks, it's just boring. It just kind of feels like nothing ever really happens. I mean, they're sort of very slowly moving along their Shane McMahon, Daniel Bryan story, wherever the hell that's going. But beyond that, it just feels like there's not a whole hell of a lot going on here on this show. And this was one of those weeks where it felt that way, but I also just didn't think it was a good show. And I don't know what's going on with SmackDown lately. I don't understand it. Why are these shows so boring lately? The Mixed Match Challenge debuted on Facebook Watch this week. WWE can no longer call Survivor Series the one night of year that the stars from Raw and SmackDown go head-to-head in competition, although I'm sure that won't stop them from saying it. I watched episode 1 after SmackDown on Tuesday with Finn Balor and Sasha Banks, Demon Boss, against Shinsuke Nakamura and Natalya. Renee Young and Byron Saxton were the hosts, who opened and closed the show. They were kind of standing in the aisleway. They threw it to the announcers. The announcers were Michael Cole, all healed up from his attack the night before, and Corey Graves. They were joined by Beth Phoenix, who was getting over the flu, who I'm sure Michael Cole was thrilled to be sitting next to somebody who was getting over the flu. Because even for just one match, apparently we cannot go without having three announcers. So We had a three-person crew. This is obviously a very social media-driven show. A lot of the pre-match promos are shot by the wrestlers using their phones. The entire time I was watching, I had all the little hearts and all the little emoticons flying across my screen. Natty gave Nakamura her father's old Heart Foundation ring jacket, which he wore to the ring, which I thought was pretty cool. I feel like that first face-off between Balor and Nakamura should have felt like a much bigger deal than it did. The match itself, I thought, was fine. It was your average match. Balor went for the coup de grace on Nakamura, but Natty tripped him, crotched him on the top rope. Nakamura had the match won for his team, but Sasha dove in at the very last second to break up the pin. There was a Kinshasa attempt. Balor dodged it. Nakamura hit the post. Sasha hit a backstabber on Natty and put her in the bank statement for the tap out. So Finn Balor and Sasha Banks now move on to meet the winner of the Miz and Asuka versus Carmella and Big E match. Mizka, still my pick to win the entire thing. At the peak of the stream, there were just shy of 130,000 live viewers, which seems like a pretty good number for their first time out. It's only one match, 20 minutes every week. They're giving $100,000 to the charity of the winning team. All the other charities, I believe, will get 10 grand apiece. There really is not much to hate on here. I like it. I think it's a cool concept. I think it's great. It's a great test for them on social media to test the waters for what very likely one day will be a full-fledged show, if not on Facebook, then on some other social media platform, because that's where the future is headed. So that's why they're experimenting with this now. Here's something to get excited about. WrestlingDVDNetwork.com reports that the success of the Unreleased Matches DVD that came out back in September, right? The WWE Unreleased Matches 1986 to 1995 DVD that came out. A full review of which, by the way, I have up on our YouTube channel right now. It's over an hour long. I talk about all the matches on there. Well, given the success of that DVD, WWE is going to be releasing another DVD featuring unreleased, never-before-seen matches focused solely on the Macho Man Randy Savage. Here's the description. Randy Savage Unreleased, the unseen matches of the Macho Man. That's the title. The Macho Man has had legendary bouts with Hulk Hogan, Rick Rude, Jake Roberts, Ricky Steamboat, and many others. The WWE Universe may be familiar with many of them, but there were several excellent matches that have never made it to DVD. Now fans can own some of the Macho Man's greatest matches that have never been released on WWE home video before. It's going to be three discs. It's due out first in the UK on May 28th, and then the very next day it gets released here in the US on the 29th. That sounds awesome. Just a bunch of Macho Man matches I've never seen before. Hey, sign me up. By the way, you've heard me talk before about how I wish WWE would start uploading old Coliseum home videos to the network. Like, just create a little section for it, start putting the old videos up. Well, I saw a note on PW Insider this week that the next plan appears to be just that, to start adding Coliseum videos to the network. That may take a back seat now because WCW Thunder may be next in line to be uploaded. I think they said next month, actually, is the 20-year anniversary of the debut of Thunder, which, you know, if that's accurate, then it makes sense that they would, you know, promote that by saying, hey, you can watch all the old Thunder episodes right now on the network. So Thunder, now that that Raven Buff Bagwell lawsuit's been dismissed and it's no longer a non-factor now, Thunder may be next on the list to be uploaded to the network. But hey, at least we know the Coliseum video stuff is on its way soon. They aren't falling on deaf ears. They've heard our pleas, and they will be on the network soon enough. I've been waiting for that for a while now. Hopefully, before the year is out, we'll have most of those videos, if not all of them, up on the network.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
We got the official announcements this week from WWE on the signings of Ricochet, War Machine, and Candice LeRae. This has been rumored for a while now. It is now official. They have reported to the Performance Center. As somebody on Facebook reminded me, I first called on WWE to sign Ricochet way back on Sound Off 127 in September of 2010. And it's crazy that it took them 7 years to sign this guy. They could have had him 4 years ago. He got a tryout. He blew everybody away. Jamie Noble, who worked, you know, as an agent or a trainer at the time, even went to bat for him and told WWE to sign him, but they had no spot for him. Now they do. And if it were me, I would start him in NXT and let him tear it up down there for a while. I have no faith, you know, them bringing him up to the main roster right away that he'll end up in a very advantageous position. I think he'd be better served. I mean, look, if they want to throw him in the Rumble as a surprise, that's fine. But I think he would be better served to start in NXT and just tear it up down there and you know, make himself, you know, even more popular amongst their fan base. And then when the time is right and they have a spot for him, they can bring him on up. War Machine, Hanson and Ro are officially in. They just worked the Tokyo Dome for New Japan. Ro, for those who don't know, is married to Sarah Logan of the Riot Squad. Them and AOP, I think, could make for some fun matches in NXT. Now, I saw Peter Rosenberg. This was kind of a big thing this week. Peter Rosenberg, who works for WWE, he got called out this week for not knowing who War Machine is. I guess he thought War Machine was a person and not a tag team. He also has an issue with them using that name because it reminds him too much of the MMA fighter of the same name who beat the hell out of his girlfriend. So I guess he feels WWE should consider changing their name, which I think is ridiculous. I just love how he got called out on Twitter by Kevin Owens, who said if his role for a certain company was to comment on things happening within said company, and they just hired a couple of really talented guys, I would probably find a few minutes to learn who they are before talking about them. It's kind of got a point there. And Candice LeRae, who we last saw in the Mae Young Classic, the wife of Johnny Gargano, she is officially in as well. I've seen a bunch of her sort of intergender matches and the stuff with Joey Ryan on the Independence, and you know, obviously those days are over. We won't be seeing her doing any of that in NXT, but we saw her in the Mae Young Classic, and she was one of the people I thought should have been in a long time ago. You know, I'm still waiting for Toni Storm to make her way back. Hopefully when she's free and clear, she'll be able to make her way over. NXT this week, and then I'll give my TakeOver predictions. I almost forgot that TakeOver was next weekend. I was like, holy shit, TakeOver's next Saturday. I've got to do predictions on this show. So we'll get to that in a little bit. But we had the long-awaited match here on this show, pitting Tino Sabatelli and Riddick Moss against Heavy Machinery, stemming from Sabatelli parking his Maserati last month in such a way that angered Heavy Machinery. Remember that random segment on TV? And so this is how we settle parking disputes here in NXT. We settle them in the ring. The highlight of the match was Otis doing the worm. Everything Otis does is just amazing. This guy is as entertaining as anybody that is anywhere on any roster right now in WWE. And so I'm sure his act will get over just fine when they eventually make their way up to the main roster. So here's this guy who I still maintain looks like the old King Kong Bundy LJN figure, the way he's like got a stick up his ass, the way that he stands. But here he is doing the worm here in this match. Unfortunately, the worm was not enough to get them the win. Riddick Moss pinned Tucker Knight with his feet on the ropes. The referee did not see it, and so the heels got the win. Another impressive showing on this show, albeit another loss for Fabian Aichner, this time against Roderick Strong. Thought they had a good match. Strong won with the Strong Hold, which is the old Chris Jericho Lion Tamer. After the match, Roddy took the mic and made it very clear he's got his sights set on Lars Sullivan. We got a really good video package about the returning TM61, Nick Miller and Shane Thorne. They've been off TV now for, I mean, God, probably the better part of a year after Shane Thorne's knee injury. Some cool footage of them training with Harley Race, who broke them in. We're getting a part two next week. I don't know if that's the last part, if there'll be a third part, but this is exactly what they need to do to reintroduce these guys to the audience. And frankly, they were pretty vanilla on TV before. You know, talented guys, but wasn't a whole lot of flair, wasn't a whole lot of spark there. So getting to know them better, I think, is nothing but a plus. Lacey Evans, another Mae Young Classic competitor, she beat Aaliyah with a punch to the face. They keep the moves real basic here in NXT. She took the microphone afterwards, the first time she's really gotten promo time. We've seen her make a few appearances, but this is really her first time to kind of shine on the microphone, and she surprised me. She cut a decent little heel promo. Got some heat for it, talked about how it's time NXT had a sophisticated lady here to clean house. This brought out Shayna Baszler. And the two of them sort of met, by the stage. Shayna stared her down. Lacey backed off. She went to the back, which is a wise move on her part. Baszler got in the ring. She put Aaliyah in a rear naked choke. That brought out Ember Moon for the save. Ember wanted to throw down right then and there, but Baszler said, "Hey, I don't have my gear, and I'll only wrestle you if you put that title on the line." And Ember was okay with this. And so Baszler told her, "Hey, bring the championship to Philly." And later in the show, William Regal gave Ember what she wanted. She made the match official for TakeOver next Saturday. It will be Ember Moon defending her NXT Women's Championship against Shayna Baszler. Now, I will say this, you know, none of this makes much sense given how destructive this woman has been since debuting only a few weeks ago. Why would Regal reward this woman with a title shot? That being said, I think it's the right move to make because I don't see there being a more compelling women's title match right now in NXT. Kairi Sane won the Mae Young Classic, but she's hurt. She's banged up. She's nursing some injuries. They can't use her. Maybe it would have been her in that spot had she not been hurt. So what do you do? Do you go with Peyton Royce? Why? So she can lose again? Because I still think her and Billie Kay are going to be up on that main roster in the next few months. They're not going to put the championship on her now if she's on her way up. Nikki Cross? We've already seen that. Bianca Belair? Yeah, you know what? You could go with Bianca Belair. She was the one who probably impressed me the most out of all those women in the Mae Young Classic. They chose not to do so. I guess, you know, better not to rush her. But who else? Who else can make for a compelling women's championship match coming up at the show next weekend in Philadelphia? Shayna Baszler. Because they've done a tremendous job so far with how they've booked her. And it's only been a few weeks, but she's already, you know, come in like this human wrecking ball. This force to be reckoned with here. I can overlook the illogical booking in this case. Because, again, it's one of the few women's matches in NXT right now that has me, you know, has me pretty interested to see where it goes and what happens. I would say I'm looking forward to it. I'm more interested in what happens with the outcome. We'll talk about that in a second, though. No Way Jose is coming back next week. Who cares? Main event had the Authors of Pain beating the Street Profits to become the new number one contenders for the NXT Tag Team titles. Bad main event. Bad main event. I like the Street Profits, but it just felt like half of it was Montez Ford trapped in a front face lock. That's all this match was for the you know 4 or 5 minutes it went. Most of it was just a front face lock. That's not exciting. Angelo Dawkins finally made the hot tag. It was all for naught. Super Collider. Followed by the last chapter for the win for AOP. So that was NXT. Let's talk about TakeOver Philly next Saturday. Here's the rundown with my predictions. Here's the card as of right now. Now, this is not official, but I would not be surprised to see them add one more match. Roderick Strong against Lars Sullivan. They seem to set that up on the show this week. Last I checked, they have not officially announced it, but I'd say there's a decent chance it ends up on the show, and if it does, I'm picking Lars Sullivan. Picking Sullivan to win. Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish defend their NXT tag team titles against the new number one contenders, the former champions, the Authors of Pain. I think Fish and O'Reilly will retain. We have Adam Cole challenging Aleister Black in an Extreme Rules match. And I would think, given the rules here, that we'll see Fish and O'Reilly involved at some point. I think the streak is coming to an end. I think Aleister Black will no longer be able to call himself undefeated when this match is over. I'm picking Adam Cole to win. And I was thinking about this the other day. I was thinking about the Royal Rumble. And a thought occurred to me. What if Aleister Black loses on Saturday? He loses to Adam Cole. But then he enters the Royal Rumble match as a surprise entry. Wins the entire thing. And goes on to challenge AJ Styles for the championship at WrestleMania. What would the reaction in Philly be if Aleister Black makes his main roster debut that night in the Rumble and wins the entire Rumble match? Imagine it coming down to him and Roman Reigns, playing with the fans' emotions like that, and the reaction he would get, you know, if he dumps out Roman, or somebody else comes in and dumps out Roman. I'm just, you know, just thinking about that. Would they have the balls to do something like that? Because we've never seen that before. We've never seen, like, an NXT guy in the Rumble make that sort of impact, let alone win the entire thing. And, I mean, it would make for a cool surprise, the guy's got a superstar entrance, and it's not like he isn't ready for the main roster if they want him. If they called him up tomorrow, it's not like he's not ready to rock, you know, on the main roster, either one, Raw or SmackDown. Just an idea. Just an idea to file away. We have Ember Moon and Shayna Baszler for the NXT Women's Championship. What do you do in this match? Shayna Baszler probably should not be getting a title shot. But I said earlier, logic goes out the window. I'm looking at the match that I want to see the most. What match among the women right now would I like to see? Is it Ember Moon against Billie Kay or Peyton Royce? No, not really. Is it Nikki Cross? Yeah, we've already seen that. Is it Aaliyah or Lacey Evans or somebody like that? Absolutely not. So who else is there? There's Shayna Baszler. Shayna Baszler has been the talk of the town amongst the women's division in NXT the last few weeks. She's come in. She's killing everybody. And so, you know, I don't fault them for making the match, but do you put the championship on her? It's one thing to give her a shot, but this early? You know, she's had, what, one match? Literally one match, I think, on TV so far. Do you put the championship on her? It's not unheard of for somebody to make their debut on a roster and win a championship in their very first match. We saw it with Paige. Her first night on the main roster, Paige beat AJ Lee to become the women's champion. So it's not something that's unheard of. I think Shayna Baszler is going to win the championship. And if it were me, I'd put the title on her. Why not? Ember could fight for it afterwards, right? The babyface trying to get her title back. Then she could lose again. And eventually, Kairi Sane is going to be ready to come back. And I think it would make sense to do something with Kairi Sane and Shayna Baszler playing off the finals of the Mae Young Classic. You know, Shayna got beat. She hasn't forgotten about that. So I think to do something with the two of them would be kind of cool when Kyrie's able to come back. You know, you have options as far as, you know, what you want to do with her as the champion. I mean, I hesitate to call her the Brock Lesnar of the women's division of NXT if she wins that title because, you know, I want her to show up a little more often than Brock Lesnar does. So, but you kind of get my point. She could be that for the women's division in NXT. And I think they could use that because, you know, they've lost a lot of women in that division. And I think they've done a decent job of sort of replenishing the ranks. And they have other women coming in soon. Candice LeRae just signed. She'll be on TV, I'm sure, soon enough. But they lost a lot of people. They lost Asuka. I mean, you know, there's been a decent number of people they've lost, and they've got to try to generate some interest somehow. And this is one way to do it. So I not only would I put the title on her, I think they will. And I think she's going to become the new champion. And then we have Andrade Cien, and by the way, before I get to that, here's another point. If you're going to do this, which they obviously are, she should not be losing this early. So by virtue just of putting her in this match, she almost has to win because she should not be losing this early into her run. Now, you could do some sort of a finish where she, you know, doesn't release a hold on the count of five, chokes out Ember Moon, gets disqualified, leads to a rematch maybe in New Orleans. You could do that too. That's sort of your way out. But I still think the ultimate end to this is her winning the championship. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. But she should not be losing in her first big match at a takeover show. Main event is Andrade Cien Almas defending his NXT championship against Johnny Gargano. This should be a fantastic match. We've seen them have, I believe, two takeover matches, in fact, before. They've had excellent matches. There's no reason to think that this would be any different. Now they're in the main event. They're in prime position, pole position here. I'm sure they're going to want to tear down the house. Never doubt Johnny Gargano. And frankly, you know, Andrade Cien Almas may not be the most exciting guy in the world, but when he goes, when he has those big matches, he almost always delivers. And I've made that comment before. It was kind of surprising. You know, he was never one of my favorites. He would come out, I would hear his music, and I would be like, ugh, oh God. But more often than not, whether he was in there with Oney Lorcan or any of the other people that he's wrestled, you know, a few minutes into the match, he kind of turns the jets on, and it's like, wow, this is actually a really good match, and he always impresses me. And I feel it would be a big mistake to take the championship off of him now, because he's hardly had any run. He just won the championship. He just won the title. You can't take it off him this early. At least give it until New Orleans. And if Aleister Black doesn't debut in the Rumble, if he doesn't hit the main roster before then he would be, you know, a good choice to maybe put the championship on in New Orleans. Or you do a three-way WrestleMania weekend. CN Almas, Adam Cole, Aleister Black. You want Black on the main roster? Fine, put the title on Adam Cole. But I think to take the title off him now would be a mistake. Now, it would be a great moment to see Johnny Gargano in the ring with the championship. What an emotional moment. But I would rather them have Tommaso Ciampa cost him his glorious moment, rip his heart right out of his freaking chest, and set up a match between the two of them in New Orleans at the next TakeOver show. Now, all of this is predicated on how quickly Ciampa is able to come back. I've heard nothing about him. There's been no update on him. It's like he's fallen off the face of the earth, and I wonder if part of that is because he's going to make the surprise run-in at the show next Saturday. But imagine the heat on this SOB. If he comes out and Johnny is within a hair of winning the championship, and Ciampa costs him the title. Leaves him just laying, broken soul, broken heart. And it finally leads to the match between them in New Orleans. I think that would be tremendous. And he would be the most hated man in the world. So I'm hoping that's how this goes down. And I also see that if my predictions come true here, it's a clean sweep for the heels, which I feel like they've done that before. They've had very heel-heavy shows where the heels almost all win. It seems a little unrealistic. You would think they'd want to throw a babyface win in there. I could be wrong, but I'm predicting a sweep for the heels on this show next weekend. This week's sad tweet comes from Jim Ross, who tweeted this out on Thursday. He said, "This morning, Norman, Oklahoma, Judge Stephen Stice felt compelled to dismiss the vehicular homicide charge against the 17-year-old and my wife Jan's death. The state objected, but to no avail. The driver never even lost his driver's license. Sad world in which we live." That's awful. That is just an awful story from every angle. It is just such an awful story, an awful outcome. Now, we aren't privy to all of the details that the judge knows about, but the fact that the state objected tells me that they felt charges of some kind were warranted here. The judge felt otherwise. The DA filed it as a juvenile case, and the kid's attorney says that he thinks Jim Ross was misinformed by the DA about exactly what happened. He said the juvenile system is very different from the adult system and that his client met every condition of his probation, which apparently included counseling and community service. Now, I know at the time, Meltzer, I think, reported that the driver was texting, or the belief was that the driver was texting at the time of the accident, but that's never been confirmed. He's been the only one who I've heard say that, and that was many months ago. Now, maybe that was what JR told him. Maybe JR shared that with Meltzer. Because I know the two of them are friendly. It's possible somebody said that to JR. He relayed that information to Dave. And, you know, maybe that part wasn't accurate. I don't know. But even in the absence of all the facts, and even if you take the texting part away, and we don't have all the facts. That's just the way it is. We don't have all the facts here. It still just seems wrong. It is wrong that they never even saw fit to suspend or revoke this kid's license. That is just, it's appalling. It is appalling, and I feel bad for JR's entire family. Just what a tragedy that whole thing is. Speaking of sad tweets, on a bit of a lighter note, after nearly 15 years on the air, Spike TV, the former home of WWE Raw and TNA Impact Wrestling, is no more. It has been rebranded as the Paramount Network, which is more of a general entertainment channel, scripted shows and whatnot. Impact lives and Spike is dead. Who would have ever thought that? The company staged what really is quite the genius little social media campaign this week. They convinced people that somebody running the Twitter account for Spike was hell-bent on causing chaos since they were losing their job. And so they decided to go rogue on the account and go on a tweet storm. Now, I wasn't sure myself at first if it was real or not, but after a couple of hours when the tweets weren't taken down, it became pretty obvious that they didn't want them taken down because it was all bullshit. And I think most people figured it out, but a lot of people didn't. It all started with this. The guy posted, "Well, since I'm out of here anyway, I might as well tell you all the things that I've been holding in for the past 18 years. Brace yourselves, bros. Shit's about to get real. Hashtag goodbye Spike. Hashtag Spike Unfiltered." And then they just kept tweeting as the day went on. There's a reason all of our early shows were CSI, UFC, TNA, MXC, and UTI. No one around here knew how to read. When we greenlit TNA, we thought we were buying something entirely different, but wrestling turned out to be okay. I honestly thought Catch a Contractor was a show about STDs. My favorite number is 329 because it's the number of times Cops is on every single night. So anyway, this went on and on. Was it lame? Yes, it was. It was lame. But you know what's genius about it? Is that were it not for their little fabricated disgruntled employee here, I never would have even known that Spike was being rebranded as the Paramount Network. I'll bet you a lot more people now know about them than they would have if they would have just put a simple press release out. Still though, Impact outlives Spike. How the hell does that even happen? It's time for the mailbag. So if you have questions, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in, such as Ryan from Ackworth, Georgia. Any chance we will see James Storm in the Royal Rumble? He left TNA Global Force Impact last November, and I haven't really heard anything about him since. Well, I mean, look, there's always a chance. I mean, he told Sports Illustrated his ultimate goal is to get to WWE. I don't see a need for him on the main roster right now, but it'd be cool to have him come out, maybe do a quick little back and forth with Bobby Roode in the Royal Rumble match. By the way, EC3 was pulled this week from an indie show he was scheduled for the day of the Royal Rumble, with no explanation given other than the obvious. And he was also spotted on Tuesday at the WWE Performance Center. So you put two and two together, I would say there's a far better chance he shows up as a surprise in the Rumble rather than James Storm. He is free and clear. EC3 is. He is free and clear to go wherever he chooses as of right now, immediately. And he has no non-compete or anything like that. And he owns the rights to his name. So they can call him EC3 if they want to instead of Derek Bateman. I think it would be terrible to call him Derek Bateman. Even if they don't want to keep the Carter name, right, because it comes from Dixie Carter, if they don't want to keep the Carter name for some reason in Ethan Carter, they could call him, Cartwright or Cambridge or something douchey sounding along those lines. No offense to anybody named Cartwright or Cambridge. But in his case, his whole gimmick in TNA when he first came in was the Silver Spoon, the nephew of Dixie Carter, and, Carter III, and he was meant to come off as a douche. So if he were to come in with that same kind of character, I think something like Cartwright or Cambridge just sort of came to me when I was thinking about it before. I was thinking of like a suitable replacement for Carter. I'm like, hey, either one of those names would work. Just the name Ethan Cambridge makes you want to punch him in the face. So I think that could work. Steve from Dover, England. What do you think of the idea that's been going around to have EC3 go to NXT and form a group with Tino Sabatelli and Riddick Moss as their leader and call the group the 1%. I had not heard that idea until you emailed me about it, but I'm actually not against it. I do think EC3 could probably just go straight to the main roster. And I'm not sure Sabatelli and Moss are ready for a call-up just yet, but if they are, or when they are, I think they would go perfectly with EC3. I feel like they got to trust EC3. Like, if he's going to lead a group, they have to trust that he can do that. I have no idea if they trust him to do that or not. I know they've brought up other groups, the Absolution, right? They put Paige with them, but then they called up the Riot Squad, and the Riot Squad is made up of all NXT women. It's not like they put them with Natty, right? Or they put them with some veteran on the main roster. They just called them up and put them together as a faction. So, I don't know, the idea of EC3 with Sabatelli and Moss, given the characters they play in NXT, I think that could work. I think somebody once floated that idea for Miz as well. Maybe having them become the new Miztourage. And I thought that was also not a bad idea. But, the EC3 thing could work as well. And give him other people to play off of. And don't forget, Rockstar Spud is due to debut any day now on the 205 Live roster, which I guess would put him on the Raw roster technically. And I wouldn't mind them doing something with EC3 and him. They had a good chemistry working together when he was basically his lackey of sorts in Impact. I guess he wasn't really a lackey, but he was sort of Dixie's right-hand person. But he worked a lot with EC3. They even had, I remember one match they had where it got pretty bloody. So I wouldn't mind seeing the two of them put together in some form or fashion. Maybe you do a whole group. Maybe EC3 leads a faction with Sabatelli and Moss, and you put Rockstar Spud with them as sort of, I mean, he's a wrestler, but he can almost sort of be their lackey or mouthpiece or whatever you want to call him. I mean, I'm just thinking of different combos here. I think that could work as well. Hanak from DC. I'm starting to feel Kenny Omega will never win the IWGP Heavyweight Championship, and if he does, it will be years away. Do you see Omega winning the title in the near future? And do you believe there was a time to pull the trigger that New Japan missed at Wrestle Kingdom 11? I think Ghetto knows what he's doing. People speak very highly of him. And a lot of what he does seems to make sense. And they tell these long, drawn-out stories. So I think he knows what he's doing. Even with Naito. Like, it felt like the time was this year's Wrestle Kingdom. But he didn't think so. And then Naito immediately transitions into a feud with Chris Jericho. So I think he'll be just fine. It's possible that Omega never wins the title, but I'm sticking with my prediction that he wins it at next year's Wrestle Kingdom. You say that if he wins it, it's going to be years away. No way. Absolutely not. He either wins it by next January or he never wins it at all. You start getting into years. I mean, you're talking years. He ain't going to be in New Japan anymore. It's by Wrestle Kingdom next year, or it never happens. Josh from Northampton, Massachusetts. With the possibility that Conor McGregor could work a program in WWE, who would you book him against? Yeah, there's been a lot of crap going on with Conor McGregor lately. Not all good either. I don't know what is going on with him lately. But if he was to work in WWE, the first name that comes to mind for me is Samoa Joe. I mean, Brock Lesnar is the easy answer. I would rather Joe get the rub from working like a high-profile feud like that. And I think the promos would be great. I mean, we know Conor could talk. The challenge for Conor, I think, would be coming to wrestling and doing promos where he doesn't drop an F-bomb every other word. But if he can do that, if he could control himself, we know that, you know, he could talk shit. We know Samoa Joe could talk shit. And I think Conor would need somebody who could talk back to him. And I think Joe could be that guy. Malcolm in Mount Vernon, New York. RVD was very over during his initial years in WWE. Do you feel Rob should have been on SmackDown during its heyday of 02-03 during that hot period? In hindsight, yeah. Yes, he should have been, given what happened to him in late 02. I think, you know, when Heyman was writing SmackDown, the whole SmackDown 6 period, that would have been a better place for RVD to be. Hanging with Angle and Benoit and the Guerreros and Mysterio. It could have been the SmackDown 7 with him there. Jordan writes in, why do people think that Hulk Hogan is such a terrible wrestler? He's no Daniel Bryan or Shawn Michaels, but Hogan has put on a few good matches over the years, such as his matches with The Rock at WrestleMania and No Way Out. Hogan's put on more than a few good matches over the years and doesn't get enough credit for it. Hulk Hogan is not a terrible wrestler, and I think people just, it's easy to shit on Hogan because he didn't do much, and he wasn't a great wrestler when you compare him to some of the other guys like Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart and, you know, Kurt Angle and people like that, but Hogan did what Hogan had to do. Hogan was very smart. He knew that in this country, he got over selling for 90% of his matches. And then making the big comeback and hulking up and dropping a leg drop. And then he would pose. Because 50% of what he would do was pose. That was most of his act. It wasn't even the matches. It was the posing. It was the cupping of the ear. That's what Hogan was. He was charismatic. But if you went to Japan, and you've seen his matches in Japan, you can bring any of them up on YouTube. He was like a different wrestler. I mean, he wasn't doing, you know, dives and stuff like that. Or some of the Saito suplexes and stuff, but his style in Japan was very different than it was here in this country, and you would see him doing things in matches over there that you would almost never see him do in this country. Now, why was that? Because he knew that it was a different audience over there. He couldn't do the same things there that he could get away with here. It's just two completely different audiences. he was smart enough to recognize that. And he never did more than he had to. And despite that, here's a guy who's had, what, 9 back surgeries? So you can mock Hogan all you want to for having a safe style and he never did much and he never took risks. You know what? He dropped the big leg for how many years? That's probably why he's had 9 back surgeries. What does it say when a guy that people look at who they don't really think took a lot of bumps and didn't do a lot of stuff, when this guy's had, I think he's had, has he had knee replacement or hip replacement or something? 9 back surgeries, all these injuries. Imagine how some of these other guys now are going to feel 15, 20, 25 years from now. It ain't gonna be good for them. But Hogan, you know, to say that Hogan was a terrible wrestler, I think, is just wrong. It's just an inaccurate statement. It's not true. And you mentioned his match with The Rock at WrestleMania 18. That's a great example of it. Hogan and The Rock did not go in there at WrestleMania 18 and have a Matt Classic. I don't look at Hogan and Rock as having the same kind of match that, you know, Kurt Angle and Shawn Michaels did at WrestleMania 21, or that Bret Hart and Steve Austin did at WrestleMania 13, or Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker had at WrestleMania 25. It was a very basic match. If you go back and watch Hogan Rock, it was a very basic match. But it was the crowd. They ate up every single thing that Hogan did. And a big part of it was nostalgia. It was his first WrestleMania match in many, many years. Probably, what, 9 years? I'm guessing. Almost a decade. Back in Sky Dome, where he had the famous match with the Ultimate Warrior. So all of that worked to his advantage. He knew he didn't have to do much. The biggest moment of that match is when he kicked out of a Rock Bottom and he hulked up. I've never seen a crowd go crazy like that in my life. That's one of those events that when people ask me, are there any wrestling shows you regret not being at live? That's one of them. I would have loved to have been in the crowd that night. So his matches, it also depended on who he was in the ring with. But, you know, Hogan, back in his heyday, was always facing the big, halfy, mobile guys. I mean, no offense to Bundy and them, but, you know, but when he was in there with the Warrior, they had a surprisingly good match at WrestleMania 6. He had a really good match with Savage at WrestleMania 5. I mean, the match with Andre at WrestleMania 3 was the shits, but for historical purposes, you won't find another match more famous than that one. He came back in 02, jobbed to everybody, but had the match with Rock at WrestleMania, which I think is one of the greatest Mania matches of all time. Had the matches with the under, or the match at Judgment Day anyway, with The Undertaker, which really wasn't any good. But he had a match at King of the Ring with Kurt Angle, for God's sakes. And Kurt made him tap out. I've never seen Hogan as a babyface tap out in a match in my life before he did so to Kurt Angle. Had the match with Brock on TV, came back, had the WrestleMania match with Vince, which I also felt like the WrestleMania match with Vince was better than it had any right to be. You know, the way they mapped that match out was genius. They had the best possible match those two could have been expected to have. So Hogan can do what, you know, Hogan feels he has to do, and that's all he has to do. He does not have to do more than that. That does not make him a bad wrestler. He can go when he has to. And he has more than just a couple of really, really good matches on his resume. Even in WCW, if you go back, I'm sure you could find a few. You know, the match with Goldberg on Nitro. That's another historical match. Big crowd. You know, going nuts for it. You can't call that a bad match. Why? Why would that be considered a bad match? I don't consider that to be a bad match. Hogan Sting at Starrcade in 97. That's a bad match. He's had a few stinkers in his career, too. But I think people saying he's a terrible wrestler, they don't know what a wrestler is. Stav from Leeds, UK. With Raw 25 this Monday, I've decided to go back on the network and watch some of the best matches in Raw history, and I find it amazing how many of these matches were in 2004. I know they had Kane and his adventures of sexual assault with Lita, but with the work rate and talent of Benoit, Edge, Triple H, Orton, Batista, Shelton Benjamin, Chris Jericho, and Christian, is 2004 an underrated year for Monday Night Raw? That's right, 2004 also gave us Gene Snitsky kicking a baby into the crowd. I'll be honest, that was in the middle of the whole Triple H Reign of Terror period, or maybe the tail end of it. And even though Benoit had the belt for like 5 months of that year, I still associate that year with being part of one of my least favorite eras of Raw. Now, we did get some real good matches. I'm not going to say we didn't. We had Benoit Shawn Michaels for the first time. We had an Iron Man match between Benoit and Triple H. I remember liking the Randy Orton Mick Foley stuff. They had that match at Backlash, which was really good, actually, for the Intercontinental title. But on the whole, I'm not a fan of Raw that year. I'm really not. 2004 was not one of my favorite Raw years at all. And they had the Evolution stuff, too. You could find some nuggets of gold in there, but not a year that I would want to go back and rewatch. Jason from the Bronx. Every Sound Off listener should know your love of the 1992 Royal Rumble. I want to ask you if you can be overcritical of that show. Can you think of anything in particular you did not like about the 92 Rumble? Maybe an elimination or even something to do with the rest of the card? Of course. I mean, the most obvious thing would be Macho Man eliminating himself by accident, and then Bobby Heenan trying to cover for him on commentary. Even Gorilla Monsoon wasn't really buying what he was saying about, you know, like, no, Monsoon, you have to be propelled over the top rope by somebody in order to be eliminated. And you can't eliminate yourself, which Savage clearly did when he jumped out of the ring to go after Jake the Snake when he wasn't supposed to. So that was a botch. You know, I can be critical of it in that way. But I'm more critical of the rest of the card. I mean, look, Roddy Piper and the Mountie, that was a bad match. But it doesn't really matter, because all anybody remembers is the finish and Piper winning his only singles title ever in WWE. That was a great moment. The match itself sucked. They followed that up with two terrible tag team matches, one of which involved the Bushwhackers, which is all but guaranteed that it would be a terrible match. I mean, I think the only thing the Bushwhackers ever did in WWE that I ever liked was their Hall of Fame speech. I mean, I know they had their heel run as the Sheepherders before they ever came to WWF, and they were really some pretty sick, sadistic heels. But in WWE, the only thing I ever liked or was ever really entertained by them by was their Hall of Fame speech. Their matches were absolutely atrocious. You know, the kids ate it up, but, you know, I was a kid back then. I didn't like them. I went to the first Fan Fest. I have a younger brother. We walk in. The Bushwhackers are there. And this was just an open floor. It was one level, just an open floor in the rotunda of Madison Square Garden. This was back in 94. We walk in, and my brother spots the Bushwhackers. And he was terrified. He starts crying. Just uncontrollably crying because he is terrified that these guys are going to come over and lick him. He did not want to be licked by these two men. It was the funniest thing. I mean, he was crying his eyes out. I'm laughing my ass off. I spot, I think I saw the Million Dollar Man. I'm like, I'm going this way. Actually, no, you know, it was Shawn Michaels. Shawn Michaels was the first person I met there. But anyway, there's a reason I always talk about the Rumble match and not the Rumble show. Because aside from Piper winning the IC title, it was a very forgettable show. You know, it was completely forgettable. If you want to know what the best overall Royal Rumble show, top to bottom, ever was, it's either 2000 or 2001. When I talk about the 1992 Rumble, I'm exclusively talking about the Rumble match. If you want top to bottom, what's the best Rumble show ever? I think it's got to be 2000 or 2001. But as far as Rumble matches, 1992 is the best. It won't ever be topped. Because even if we get a great Royal Rumble match, I'm not saying we can't ever have a great Royal Rumble match. But even if we do, we would still have Byron Saxton on commentary with Michael Cole. And they ain't no Monsoon and Heenan. So it can never be topped. Cordell from Milton, Delaware. Do you think the injury to enhancement talent Charles Austin, who was paralyzed back in a tag match in 1990, prohibited the push of Marty Jannetty back in 92 when the Rockers disbanded? No, I think Jannetty being a fuck-up prohibited his push in 92. Wasn't he under, like, he was like under house arrest or something, I think, at that time. I'm almost positive he got in trouble with the law in some way, and it was all of his own doing, which is why, because it seemed like everything was set up for him and Shawn Michaels to have a match at WrestleMania 8. He got put through the barbershop window in January, so this was like a week maybe before the Royal Rumble, so obviously he wasn't going to be in the Rumble, but then it would make sense for him to come back and wrestle Shawn at Mania 8. And it never happened. Instead, Michaels ended up wrestling El Matador. who at least I guess you can argue, well, why do that match? I know him and Tito had a little bit of an interact. They might have even eliminated each other in the Royal Rumble match. Maybe that was the basis for why they had a match at WrestleMania 8. I don't really remember, but Jannetty got into trouble quite a few times. I'm sure it had to do with that and not because he paralyzed that guy with the rocker dropper. And even to say that Marty Jannetty paralyzed him, I think is actually being a little unfair to Jannetty. I saw the video of what happened, and the video is readily available on YouTube. It's part of a news segment that was done on this guy, Chuck Austin, many years ago. So the match itself, I don't think, is online, but it's part of that news segment. And, you know, I saw the video, and it wasn't Jannetty's fault, I don't think. From what I'm watching when I see it, it's not Jannetty's fault. The other guy took the move wrong. He landed right on top of his head. So if you've ever seen Jannetty back in the day doing the rocker dropper, he puts his leg over the guy's head, jumps up, goes straight down, right? Face plants him right into the mat. This guy obviously had no experience taking the move and ends up contorting his body in such a way where, you know, how RVD used to take that top of the head first bump on DDTs and stuff. That's how he took this move. Head first, got spiked right down into the mat. That's not Jannetty's fault. I mean, you can blame Jannetty for not realizing how injured the guy was, and he's like moving him around. And then to make it worse, Shawn Michaels gets tagged in. He comes off the top rope with like a giant fist or a splash or something off the top. Meanwhile, this guy's laying on the ground paralyzed. But the move itself, it was the guy's own fault. He just took it wrong. Taran from Detroit, buy or sell on the bigger Stone Cold return pop, his return from injury at Backlash 2000, or his return at No Way Out 2003 after walking out on the company the year before. You know, it's eerie that you sent this to me this week, because last weekend I found myself going down the rabbit hole on YouTube. I'm sure all of you have been through this before. You watch a video, it leads to another video. 45 minutes later, you're watching videos. And what I was watching was old Stone Cold videos of his biggest pops, his biggest crowd reactions. And it only reinforced what I already knew, which is that there has never been anybody in the history of WWE to get as many of those building, rattling reactions as Steve Austin did. Not Hulk Hogan, not Bret Hart, not Shawn Michaels, not The Rock, not The Undertaker, not John Cena. Nobody has gotten the type of reactions that Stone Cold did when that glass shattered. And of the two that you mentioned, I'm going to buy on the Backlash one. I'm going to sell on No Way Out. Although No Way Out, that was a gigantic one when he walked out there. I think that was at the Bell Center in Montreal. But just think of all those giant reactions that Austin got. The night on Raw where he drove the Zamboni down to the ring and then jumped off onto Vince, which was one of my all-time favorite Raw moments. And here's a fun little exercise for you. When I mention each one of those moments, okay, I want you to go find the clip on YouTube and just watch the crowd. Don't even pay attention to like the moment itself and what's going on. Watch the crowd. Don't just listen to them. Watch them when he comes out, okay? The Zamboni, the beer truck, his entrance 3 months removed from spinal fusion surgery, when he came out of Backlash and he smashed six people in the head with a steel chair. The night the old Stone Cold came back during the invasion and he stunnered about 10 different people. The No Way Out return against Bischoff that you mentioned. The night he was announced as the guest referee for the Battle of the Billionaires in 2007 for WrestleMania. And the biggest pop of them all, maybe the loudest one that I have ever seen, the loudest one that I have ever heard, and I admit I was not in the building that night, I only watched it on TV, but still, the biggest ovation I have ever seen in my entire life, when the glass shattered, January 4th, well, it didn't happen on the 4th, but it aired, on January 4th, it was a tape show, 1999, the night that Mick Foley won the WWF title from The Rock, okay, the infamous night when Tony Schiavone was ordered by Eric Bischoff to talk about how Mankind winning the title was going to put the butts in the seats. When that glass shattered, go back and look at that crowd. Everybody rose to their feet in unison before the first chord of the actual song even hit. The music itself didn't even start. All that happened was the glass shattered. And I have this hilarious image in my head of what the lobby, the concession level, right? What that must have looked like. All those people waiting in line to get food, hearing the glass, and just like rushing back into the arena all at once, probably stampeding people along the way, like get out of the way. Or some dude like in the bathroom who's got stage fright. Let's say he's got stage fright. He knows the people outside the stall can hear him. I can't do it. I can't go. And all of a sudden, Stone Cold's music hits, and he's just like, thank you, God. Because there's nothing but noise. You can't hear anything else. Like, there will never be another period like that again. I miss those crowds so damn much. I really do. The reactions, the sea of signs. I mean, it sucked if you were sitting behind them. But God, I miss that. And actually, I have a Twitter account all of you should follow. Let me bring it up here because I posted something about this the other day. And people were blown away. They didn't even know this Twitter account existed. It's a Twitter account that is dedicated to nothing but Attitude Era signs. So if you go to @AEraSigns, so it's the letter A, Era Signs. It is just a Twitter account that is dedicated to nothing but showing you signs from the Attitude Era. And it's pretty much what you would expect. But it's hilarious to watch when you really go back and see some of these ridiculous signs that people would, and inappropriate signs that people would bring to these shows. But just always the sea of them. Like, it just looked like, I don't even know how to describe it. It looked like just a party, you know, every single week. Again, unless you were sitting behind those signs, then you probably weren't very happy. But there'll never be another like Stone Cold. When it comes to crowd reactions, there's nobody who could touch him. Speaking of fan reactions, that brings me to Travis from Saratoga Springs. What is the story behind the sickening chair shot Undertaker gave Mr. Kennedy at Survivor Series 2006? There had always been stories about Kennedy having heat backstage and that he got on the bad side of the wrong people, which he did. I mean, that's just a fact. In the end, he did, because that's why he got fired. I honestly don't know if that was the case here or if this was just Undertaker's way of breaking him in. Like, you know, you want to be a main eventer? Welcome to the club, pal. And then he just bashes his brains in. But boy, did Undertaker look like he had some malice behind that chair shot. That was attempted murder, is what that was. I don't know that it's sicker than the chair shot to the face that Jeff Hardy gave Brock Lesnar that one time on Raw. But this was one of the sickest chair shots I've ever seen in my life. And the crowd, if you look at the faces of the people in like the first 5 or 10 rows, when he paced this guy in the head with that chair, they look absolutely horrified. Every last one of them, they look absolutely terrified. They look genuinely disturbed by what they just saw. Like, it's not even like, yeah, fuck yeah, chair shot, yeah. It's like, oh my God, is he alive? Whatever the real story behind it, Undertaker looked like he definitely had it out for the guy, and I don't know why. Whatever he may have done, there's no justification for hitting somebody that hard in the head with an unprotected chair shot. So he didn't even get his hands up. I'm not even sure he had time to get his hands up. So he has to bear some of the blame for that. At least get your freaking hands up. To take an unprotected chair shot to the head and that hard, I don't care if it's a different era or not. There's never any justification for that at all. Because that was not a safe chair shot. He scrambled that guy's brains. And didn't look like he regretted doing it either. Keep sending in those questions. TheSolomonster @gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter @Solomonster. There's a lot of events coming up. Raw 25 on Monday. NXT and the Royal Rumble next weekend. So I'll be live tweeting during those shows. You can follow along on there. Don't forget, WrestlingRadioAwards.com. You can vote every day. You got one more week to vote. And the Royal Rumble Facebook poll. You got another week to join. If you're still waiting in queue, drop me a message, tweet, whatever. Let me know. Because you can't get into the group unless I approve you. And I know some people were stuck in queue, and there is still time to get in. So you can let me know about that. But again, over 1,800 strong, 63 pools, soon to be 64, 65, 66. How high can we go? I don't know. That's up to you guys. But get in on that. And I will probably be doing a Sound Off Extra review for Raw 25 that will go up exclusively on YouTube early Tuesday morning. If that changes, I'll let everybody know on Twitter if for whatever reason I can't do it, but that is the current plan, so you guys won't have to wait an entire week to get my thoughts on that. And then next weekend is episode 532. I'll have my NXT TakeOver review, Royal Rumble predictions, any last-minute breaking news on that. A lot of news, a lot of big stuff coming up, and I hope you'll keep it right here and join me for all of that. So until next time, be well, stay safe. Thank you, as always, for your support and leaving all those glowing reviews on iTunes and Stitcher and making this a 5-star rated podcast. I very much appreciate that. And I will see you back here again for episode 532 next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
They have Kane in the back. This is what he said. Tonight, I will delight as I enter the abyss with a fellow monster. But it is I who will climb out alone and with a smile across my face.
Oh, oh my God.
What do they think this is, Shakespeare?
I was driving yesterday and some asshole double parks his car in the service lane.
I should have cut a promo the way the WWE would script one out for me. Why art thou parking like one's smelly orifice? I wish 1,000 deaths upon thee. Then I could do a fucking tope and we could fade to commercial.
Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.